Welcome to Ufahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm Rachel Bede-Riedel, one of your hosts, along with my co-host Kim Yi Dion. This week, we are joined by Professor Kwadwo Owusu, a professor in the Department of Geography and Resource Development at the University of Ghana, Legon, and director of the Center for Climate Change and Sustainability Studies. Professor Owusu joins us while tuning in from a talk he gave at Cornell University's Institute for African Development, and we chat about climate and society, politics and public policy around environmental health and well-being, and what issues are on the horizon as we consider natural resource changes, technological changes, social changes surrounding climate adaptations. We also talk about the politics of Global South and Global North and the costs and benefits of climate and how to address it. Take a listen.
Professor Owusu, thank you so much for joining us today here at Cornell, the Institute for African Development. We're really pleased to have you here as the Distinguished Africanist Professor and to learn from your work on mining and deforestation and agricultural transformation, and also as the Director at the University of Ghana, Legon, for the Center for Sustainability. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to talk with you today about big picture questions in Ghana in particular, but also kind of thinking broadly across the African continent. And in terms of how to address climate change, how to think about securing healthy environments for people, for other animals, for livelihoods and food security, both today and in the future for future generations. So I was wondering, taking that kind of big picture question, if you could start off by telling us what are some of the biggest challenges to securing healthy environments that you see in Ghana and also more broadly across the continent today. And then we'll get to the kind of optimism about what to do about it.
Thank you very much. I must say that I'm delighted to be here for the hospitality extended to me. And I'm happy to talk about the perspective of how to create sustainable environments in Africa for people and for ecosystems and the like. First of all, I think the challenge is we have to pay attention to governance issues, environmental governance, to make sure that the direction is set from the leadership and then people who follow. If everybody identifies that plastic, it's not good for the environment. And if there is no clear legislation, then what would the people do? Because it's convenient. Mm-hmm. But if there's clear guidance, education, then some of those things can be dealt with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we need leadership, governance, and education.
Exactly. To really be able to address things that are known, like elimination of plastic. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And when you see, how do you think climate change is currently affecting just well-being right now in Ghana, for example? Do you see day-to-day ramifications? Do you see seasonal ramifications? How do you think it's impacting everyday life?
It is impacting everyday life. You see it through the loop of underdevelopment. Mm-hmm. So for urban places like this, mm-hmm. because of lack of urban resilience and proper planning, a little rainfall that shouldn't lead to flooding, mm-hmm. is flooding over poor neighborhoods and communities and people's property, and occasionally the lives are being put in danger. Mm-hmm. But even though extreme weather events associated with climate change can lead to flooding and all that. Some of the flooding events we see in the near cities and some other cities in Africa are not because of climate change, but really because the system dynamics are weak. And so it amplifies and sometimes turn into risk or hazard for people.
Absolutely. So in that way, too, the adaptation measures around kind of building infrastructure, rainwater infrastructure, public services around sanitation and water,
yes,
all of these elements are also kind of connecting the governance piece,
yes,
to making cities and places, you know, where people are living,
yes,
more adaptable to more extreme kind of weather events. Is that right?
So like you rightly said, so it's not about there's a lack of governance at all, but sometimes it's the weakness in the governance. I mean, the Greater Metropolitan Authority or Assembly does a lot of things ahead of the rainy season. You talk about seasonality, mm-hmm, to try to safeguard and to prevent flooding. But is it what they do? Is it resilient enough?
Mm-hmm.
So what they do, much of it is to desalt all these clogged river channels and so on,
mm-hmm,
to ensure free flow of water.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process itself, sometimes doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's about building stronger, resilient infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Either than that, it is the disaster management that always have a job to do.
Right, exactly. And then the cleanup, I mean, we see this across the United States as well. New York City just had catastrophic flooding.
Mm-hmm.
We see it in Miami with just like a kind of normal tidal coastal flooding. How do you see it in more rural areas across kind of questions of agriculture and food production?
Yes. So that has been the crusade of my take on how to solve this climate change problem in developing countries, or for that matter, Ghana. And I say it's I'm not the first to say it, but to echo what people have said, that climate change is a developmental problem. So in agriculture in Ghana, it's almost entirely rain-fed. So seasonality of the rain drives dry spells. So in the last few years, severe drought has not been the issue. But it will rain, the farmers will plant whatever they specialize in. And in the middle of the season, then the rain stops for like a week or two. If you had a robust system and then probably augmented the rain with a little irrigation, then the farmers will not suffer.
Exactly.
But many lose their whole livelihood for that cropping season. You know, there was a two-week window that it didn't rain.
Right.
So I think it's about time to plug the system,
mm-hmm,
and do the basics. So some attempts have been made,
mm-hmm,
and harvesting rainwater and that, but I think that there has to be a dedicated focus, mm-hmm, on properly addressing such issues. Either than that, there is evidence that climate change is having a toll even on rural livelihoods.
So you see, in that case, given that 97% of the agricultural output in Ghana is natural rainfall,
mm-hmm,
only 3% is irrigated. So you see the potential, the technology is there in,
yes,
terms of the ability to adapt.
Yes.
And so if there were, you know, kind of concentrated, mm-hmm, supports in key areas,
mm-hmm,
then that harm or potential kind of the catastrophic costs of the fluctuation could be really reduced?
Could be reduced. I mean, I have no doubt about that. In Ghana, in terms of food self-sufficiency and all that, will not be an issue if you take the basis.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the staples, I mean, the prices fluctuate by the season.
Mm-hmm.
And during the harvest, yam, plantain, cassava, and the rest are so easily available and quite reasonably cheap on the market.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes a political game. The ruling people in government say, oh, look at how cheap we've made food.
Right.
And then the season is over. And then the opposition will come in and say, look at how bad things are. Look at how high prices of plantain are. And it becomes a political game. And it's the people hurting. But if we have strong processing systems, mm-hmm, and preservation and so on, then we can stabilize prices. We,
yes,
can even make agriculture more attractive.
Exactly.
And also the population will well nourished and stuff like that. So the ability to produce is really not a problem.
Right.
But how to manage the production system, the value chain.
The value chain, yeah. Exactly. So that one, it reduces food waste. Right, when the crops are ready, but yes. not all of it can be used immediately. Yes. And then two, it adds kind of the packaging and the processing value chain to the market.
Sure.
And then you have the ability, you know, just things are canned, pickled, what have you, they're available.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I asked my students who are more into human geography and the rest, and said, What does the statistics say about post-harvest losses? 20-something years ago, when I was a student, the level of post-harvest losses, which is running up to about 30%, is still the same.
It's the same.
Because there's no expansion of processing.
Exactly.
The rules are not better than before, so that even the goods can easily be cut to the market.
Right.
So these are developmental issues.
Right.
If we address those, and now we have the hindsight of climate change being real.
Exactly.
So as we do the roads, you make them climate proof.
Exactly.
As we do the factories, we take care of the impact of climate on them. Then we will be better.
Exactly. So really, in terms of adding to that value chain and you know, increasing the yield from the production,
yes.
It's in part about the factories to allow for the food processing,
yeah.
And then also about the roads.
Yeah.
And those would be the two kind of key zones that could really add value, but also make more resilient.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, of course. You know, the government tries, in Ghana, at least there is this project of cocoa roads. So the government tries to make sure that hinterlands or remote areas that produce cocoa are connected so that you can carry cocoa to the market. But it is incremental and it looks insignificant because the problem is so huge.
Mm-hmm.
So many areas are not well connected with food roads.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of the links in the chain. And you need to get it fixed.
Exactly. So now I want to talk about kind of perceptions of climate change more generally. Like, so here we're sitting in New York State and in the United States, and certainly within the US, there's not one single view, that to put it as an understatement, about what is climate change, what is happening, and what needs to be done about it. You multiply that across what we might call, you know, quote unquote, the West or the global North, you just exponentially add the numbers of perspectives. So this may be an unfair question, but with that in mind,
yeah.
So the Global South, right? We hear every year, you know, there are these conferences, these questions about how are we across the world, how can we respond to climate change?
Yes.
So for our audience, can you summarize like the variety of perspectives that you hear around what is climate change, what to do about it,
mm-hmm.
from various perspectives from the Global South?
Well, so from the Global South, I think it's not very contentious that people are clearly accepting the fact that the globe has warmed,
mm-hmm.
which aligns with the IPCC's pronouncement,
mm-hmm.
and then in terms of how that then manifests and translates into other climatic patterns. Of course, there will be different views depending on where you are. The misnomer on the street is that people want to equate rainfall with temperature. And I go to that because in our part of the world, the tropics, the most important variable is rainfall. It's warm throughout the year, but winds are not that strong that cause that much damage. So people sometimes wrongly say that, oh, because of climate change, it's not raining.
Mm-hmm.
But the statistics, at least in the case of Ghana, is not there that the rain is reducing. It's actually the timing of the rain that really is that means the variability component that really manifests if you look at the data.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, people try to blame a lot of the challenges on climate change. So people have caught on. But in terms of regional global south perspective, I think people are catching on to the fact that Africa is not responsible. I mean, we only contribute around 4% of global emissions. Historically, we have even contributed less.
Exactly.
So, no. So that then drags in into the discussion on loss and damage.
Yes.
And so people think that Africa is suffering a burden they haven't really been the proponents of creating. So why shouldn't they be helped to solve it? Other people in the different parts are also interested in adaptation in general. Mm-hmm. But that is an issue. It's affecting us now. So we are not going to, we are interested in planting trees to mitigate. But that's a long-term view. Mm-hmm. Now, what about now?
Mm-hmm.
So I think these are some of the perspective that is around the continent.
Mm-hmm.
Should we discuss loss and damage?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Africans are very interested in discussing loss and damage. But are our development partners interested in that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because who is going to pay?
Mm-hmm.
How best to assess it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it, should we focus on mitigating to solve the problem,
mm-hmm.
or adaptation? But
mm-hmm.
mostly there is also the view that, yeah, because it's an issue happening now, yes, let's do the mitigation, but let's do more of an adaptation that is to have mitigation synergies.
Exactly. Right.
Hand in hand sort of thing.
Exactly. In some senses, the loss and damage, adaptation and mitigation can all go together,
sure.
But it's often a question, as you were saying, as you've opened with, of governance,
yeah.
And then also a question of how to finance.
Yeah.
Right. And so the adaptation strategies themselves can have mitigation
yes.
strategy built in.
Yes.
How do people see the question of energy, electricity,
yeah.
use of fossil fuels?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a desire to use alternatives, or is there a desire to think about what resources do we have that we can use, and then kind of next stage where yeah. we're headed?
Yeah, good question. So in terms of energy, most African countries are really looking at availability, mm-hmm. having enough.
Yes.
Already we don't have enough.
Right.
From South Africa to Tanzania, Ghana, and the rest. So what is the easier route to producing energy and producing a lot of it? So there are other technologies that may be out of the way. So as a necessity, that then cripples what governments are able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like when the U.S. government came to Ghana with the Millennium Pact trying to help the energy sector.
Mm.
And I was happy, very refreshing to me as an academic listening to the opposition that everything is on the table,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the sources of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Because you first have to have enough,
mm-hmm.
attain independence,
right.
and then work your way to eliminating the ones that are not helping. That may be a radical view to others,
mm-hmm.
but if people don't have electricity to power water, sanitation systems,
mm-hmm.
it's very difficult to tell them, no, you cannot use fossil fuel to produce energy.
Mm-hmm.
You may say, but how practical is it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, advanced industrial nations that have tried to radically cut fossil fuels and nuclear power in some instances, and have to go back because you need to have enough energy before you can. So I would say that Africa is at a tough place as at now,
mm-hmm.
because do we have to transition now, or do we have to produce enough?
Right.
So it's a very practical, delicate question.
Exactly.
Yes.
And it's interesting because in some senses, you know, the point that you made about adaptation versus mitigation,
yes.
where they can go together, it's win-win, right?
It's win-win, yes.
You can increase with solar and wind, etc. Yeah. But at the same time, if you're not yet at the stage of having enough, then all cards are on the table.
You can be wanting to stake a lot of wind turbines in your country when you don't even have enough strong wind to harness.
Right.
So it's a challenge. I mean, now you know what is clean energy and stuff like that, but will it work for you? Can you produce enough from that? So even like the advanced industrialized nations, some keep shifting their deadline for going completely green because the practicality of the issue is not academic. It's about bread and butter issues for people.
Correct.
I just have enough power.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I just saw a headline yesterday in the New York Times that, you know, the largest fossil fuel emitting countries like the United States are way over their targets for what they agreed to, and they continue to use more fossil fuels. And so in that way, the UK is opening new coal plants.
That's the point.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And it's really fascinating. We were talking in an earlier episode with Cyril Obi, who works on mining and energy in Africa as well. And one of the points he was making, I'd love to get your take on, is that because Africa across the continent is so rich in the mineral resources that are needed to power a green economy, right? The batteries in particular, that the new kind of questions of extraction and natural resource curse or governance, how can these sectors be governed in order to benefit the local population?
Yeah.
These are the questions of like the next generation of energy. And I was wondering how you see that playing out right now. Is there an infrastructure, a set of priorities, a sense of how to govern mineral extraction in a way that can help to avoid some of the challenges of oil extraction?
Yeah. So it goes down to governance. And some countries, including Ghana, are trying to, knowing what resource has done in the past, trying to put in the safeguards and policies, especially when new discoveries are made before mining begins. There has to be in place some rules and regulation. But we know is the governance is only from the African side. The people extracting all within the value chain, everybody wants to make profit. So if they can go around regulation, better for some companies, not all. So I think it's not only the African government, but within the regulatory framework globally, attention has to be put on these questions of justice and good governance within the extraction industry.
Absolutely. So, I mean, there you bring up a really interesting point about the multi-level, right? Because you have the multinational corporations or the, you know, investments from external, you know, foreign direct investment, kind of Chinese, Americans, et cetera, et cetera. Then Ghanaian firms, and then local miners, local actors. And then you have regulation that's at the level of the country, but you also have the regulation that's at the level of regional organizations, let's say ECOWAS or SADC or even African Union.
Yeah.
But then you also have the potential for regulation at the level of the consumer market. So let's say the state of California puts in regulation about what kind of mining certificate one needs to have for the battery production.
Yes.
I mean, that could have major
implications
for the whole chain, right?
Yes.
So where do you see the points of governance? Is it all across or where do you think the big levers are that could be pulled?
I think the conspicuous point is the local governance, at the national level of the countries. In which this extraction is done. It's easier to identify and to engage. because, as you said, if California puts in a fair trade or certification for a mineral, and what about if it is being sold in another market?
Right.
Would that then apply? Mm-hmm. So in-house, if we have safeguards that really take people at heart and protect the rights of the local people,
right,
I think it will be easier and it will be better.
So let's talk about some examples of that, because I totally agree, right? Like the national government has the context to understand how regulation will affect the miners, the local communities, the water sources, et cetera, right? So they have the best place knowledge to be able to refine regulation in a way that could be people protecting, right? And environment protecting for healthy environments that are long-term resources for thriving. So yesterday in your talk, you were telling us about kind of transition from agriculture to mining zones in Ghana. In particular here, the case would be gold mining. Mm-hmm. But you were telling us about the Ghanaian Operation Vanguard, which it sounds like a bit of an attempt to do some regulation around mining and how it's done and what consequences it has. So can you tell our audience a little bit about Operation Vanguard and how it's working or not working, and you know, how it could maybe work better or what needs to be done in this space using that example?
Well, so the Operation Vanguard was just like the enforcement arm of the government policy to regulate the small-scale gold mining environment. So the government came into power where small-scale miners were everywhere within the gold belt, or wherever they could find the gold, they were using metals that were not sustainable. Mm-hmm. So the government actually had a broader view of trying to regulate the market or the environment. But slowly, Operation Vanguard was the aspect where the government wanted to halt the operation of the small-scale gold mining and to then engage. So there were announcements made that you have to stop, we will cushion you, we will give you training to do responsible mining. And so a task force of military and police were put together to go to the mining areas to stop, to enforce the government's decision to halt the small-scale activity. And it was difficult. There wasn't a buy-in from the miners, and that had made it difficult. It wasn't overly successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't say over. It hasn't really worked. The mining still goes on, and the waters are still, or the rivers are still.
Because the chemicals used in the gold mining, like the cyanide.
That's the use of proper, the rivers are polluted.
Yes.
So all of that is still going on. So the government is reconsidering what to do. So if you talk about that operation, it really wasn't able to stop.
Exactly. And in part, you know, what we were just talking about was an attempt to regulate the conditions around mining. And here the Operation Vanguard was really an attempt to halt it completely. I mean, do you see a kind of happy, a different route there that could get the buy-in from local miners that would not end it completely, but would protect the environment and the miners themselves?
It's difficult to say, because the Operation Vanguard, as I understand it, was not trying to stop mining, but the non-sustainable way of mining is what was being done. And the government had additional programs to train and regulate. So I think it was a good program.
Yes.
But people are enjoying the profits from the illegal activity.
Right.
So if you ask me, I don't know if I would look at designing something different, but I will improve the enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are caught doing what the state has decided not to be done, you should be punished.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably could serve as a deterrent. Right. I think that is where the weakness is.
Right.
Probably.
Exactly.
But not. The framework, I think, was good. It was detailed enough. It wasn't just everybody must stop mining.
I see.
I said, stop the irresponsible mining. Mm-hmm. Don't wash gold in the streams.
Right.
Stay. Rules were there already. How far away you could put your activity away from the streams. So let's enforce that.
Exactly.
So I don't see how you can fault.
Right.
Such an attempt.
Exactly. It wasn't an attempt to end
everything
completely, but let's make these practices safe.
Yeah, safe.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, too, thinking about the kind of, I mean, this is, we're talking gold in Ghana, but you multiply it across cobalt in DRC and, you know, all of the rare earth and the lithium. I mean, this is very relevant, you know, across the continent. So one other implication, actually two, is that those areas that then become mining centers are no longer available for agricultural production. And the second is that the land itself, maybe beyond where the mining is happening, becomes polluted for potentially many generations. So it's not just the kind of current land use patterns, but the implications for future. So one of the things that you mentioned is the potential for decarbonization schemes, right, to be able to use land that is polluted to plant trees, even though you can't produce agriculture from it. How do you see that as entering into the set of potential policies or mindsets of local
people?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that it's not a conclusive statement. I'm looking at a research opening.
Mm-hmm.
Can we investigate the potential?
Mm-hmm.
Or to what extent is the damage? What can grow on the land? How long will it take for you to be able to regenerate the land? But if you did, knowing historical comparisons, would it be good to be thinking about growing food on such land?
Mm-hmm.
If not, in the era of climate change, is it possible to look at carbon credits in areas like that?
Right.
So for me, as a researcher, I don't have a definite answer to that. But I think it's a good place to research into.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a climatologist, I believe that the rainfall will still be there.
Yes.
So how do you then harness it?
Mm-hmm.
It will reduce because the vegetation has gone.
Mm-hmm.
But the lighter drivers of the rainfall will mean that there still will be some good amount of rain.
Exactly.
But what will you use it for?
Right.
Are you going to allow the land to lay bare?
Right.
So can we probably as part of the government initiative, can we commission research into now beginning to look at what are the alternatives do we have as a. And I believe if we can bring some trees back, we can improve biodiversity as well.
Exactly, exactly. And do you see any role or potential for coordination at the continental level in terms of the African Union? Are they taking up the issue of healthy environments? Or is it really, it needs to be at the national level because of that proximity to the questions.
To the questions.
Mm-hmm.
I think the African Union is becoming active in the fight against climate change and environmental issues in general. They are now collaborating with the European Union with research funding.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the African Union in this context will be useful in the sense that sometimes the grants and the resources now be needed to clearly research into coming out with solutions, maybe beyond the pocket of some of the individual governments.
Mm-hmm.
So Africa being non-coordination in this area would be useful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Wonderful.
And as you look ahead, I mean, the nature of climate change, as we see from the graphs, is kind of exponential change.
Sure.
Right. And so one of the things that I think you've said that's really interesting is, at least in Ghana, the timing and the variability of rain is so essential because it affects planting season, yeah, right? If you plant and the seed needs water within, you know, the first 2 weeks, and that rain, that first rainfall is delayed, but then it comes as a kind of torrential, yeah, you know, rain. So the total quantity,
yes,
is remaining, but it's just that kind of change in timing, and that affects planting patterns and yield. So as you look ahead, what do you think are the things that are coming in the next 5 to 10 years? How do you think Ghana, or, you know, the rest of the continent might be experiencing climate change differently than we are today?
Yeah, so I think that what the continent should look for is the extreme weather events, mm-hmm, associated with the change. So flooding in some instances, mm-hmm, and droughts, mm-hmm, in other instances. Because, of course, even if the rainfall remains the same, it is clear that with increasing temperatures, evapotranspiration also definitely will be going up. So, mm-hmm, water really is going to be an issue for Africa.
Yeah.
And water resources management, therefore, should really recognize the challenges ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you see, you know, water is absolutely key for humans, and then for cattle herders, right, as well as the agriculturalists. Do you see in Ghana migration challenges as people move away from areas that were more consistently viable for rain fed or agriculture or cattle grazing? Do you see migration challenges and pressures?
Yeah, it's migration challenges and pressures are already going on. Ghana is urbanizing fast, mm-hmm, and a lot of the population is coming from the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
But climate change probably may not be the single most important factor.
Mm-hmm.
But agricultural transformation, mining taking over fertile agricultural lands and stuff like that, well, in the case of Ghana,
mm-hmm,
continue to push younger generations and people into the mega cities.
Yes.
So for that, I think if the planners are up early, it will be better.
Because
the signs are there.
Exactly. So even as you see the kind of the expansion of mining taking over agricultural, yeah, lands, that pushes the urbanization.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, governance, you've mentioned as a key lever. And then the other thing that you mentioned is education.
Yeah.
How do you see the role of education? Here we are, you know, both as educators.
Yeah.
Is it general publics? Is it through schools? Is it via media? I mean, what do you see? Here we sit in a very contested, mm-hmm, you know, landscape around understandings of climate change. But in Africa, as you mentioned, like, there's a general recognition.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the aim of education, and who are the target audiences?
I think the populace in general, so not necessarily just formal education, mm-hmm, but campaigns to really alert the people of the consequences of the actions,
yes,
that are taken by individuals or in their name.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the traditional authorities and stuff like that have to be supported and probably also reach out to in the sense of trying to halt some of the activities in their jurisdiction, because if the rivers are damaged,
mm-hmm,
what kind of livelihood are you going to have in your chiefdom? Who is going to be there to serve you?
Right.
So it might be glamorous, it might be nice to have the gold and the resources dug out immediately, but what is the long-term implication.
Right.
So when I talk about education, yeah, I'm not only talking about school kids and classroom education, but public education to sensitize the populace about the challenges ahead. But the fact that, unlike in the past, we have to double our efforts to be able to get out of this climate challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are the sort of education I
have in mind. And it's interesting, you know, that you mention local traditional leaders, the importance of chiefdoms. Right now, how would you describe kind of that relationship between local chiefs and their awareness of, concern about, and kind of reaction to climate change?
Some are aware. Some are actively educating their people, putting in measures to try and cushion their community. By laws are still in the business as usual frame of mind and not being innovative. So I think that the education will be necessary. Mm-hmm. And recognizing probably the power they have and the influence they can bring to bear and so on. But I don't think many of them are really dedicated to the climate fight. But if you are now spoken, then clearly engaged.
Mm-hmm. So you see that potential with some kind of early adopters and how important it is really as stewards of the land. And as you said, when you have a long-term vision, right, as the chieftaincy is a long term.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it's not just about the individuals. And so that can really help the potential of connecting to whole communities.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time, Kocha. It's really wonderful to have you here with us and to share your expertise around such an important topic for today and for tomorrow.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tomoklo. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.